Now on Bloomberg 106.1.
There's a nice cluster of ecosystem within downtown Boston, and I think that that will preserve itself.
The store is not dead. The store is theater. And we're seeing this move to shop locally.
Think about retail. We often think about online shopping, and we're actually starting to see in-store shopping stronger than it has been in quite some time.
All that's happening with venture capital and clean tech and biotech, I'm really proud of the city and proud to be part of it.
This is Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Joe Shortslave, and Kim Kerrigan on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 92.9 HD2.
All right, buckle up. Here we go. Wednesday, July the 6th. Welcome to the 2 o'clock hour of Bloomberg Bay State Business. We, of course, are here till 5 o'clock tonight. Joe Shortslave, Tom Maroney is off. Kim Kerrigan's in the co-host seat. And Mastu's handling the news duties. Jenna Wu is with us as well. We've got about 80 degrees in downtown Boston. That is one good-looking day out there. Equity markets at this very moment, well, they're mixed. The NASDAQ is slightly in the positive, and the Dow is off some 60 points. All right. Well, we've heard a great deal about the chaos that is flying these days. And I actually had to laugh, Kim. There's an article on Boston.com, and the headline is, "Don't bother flying. 10 readers share their recent airport horror stories."
It's a nightmare.
Yeah. Well, this one really sort of caught my attention. Now United Airlines is pointing the finger of blame at the Federal Aviation Administration and the air traffic control staffing issues in particular. It's a story written by Bloomberg U.S. Airlines reporter Mary Schlagenstein, who will join us at 2:15. Also in just a few minutes, President, CEO of the Worcester Regional Chamber of Commerce and former Lieutenant Governor here in the Commonwealth, Tim Murray, is going to join us. He's going to talk about, well, the business impacts that, Polar Park is having there in central Massachusetts, obviously home to the Woo Sox. But tonight, in particular, because Sox ace Chris Sale will have another rehab start there tonight, and we'll talk with Tim about, what that means, Kim.
All right, I'm looking forward to that. You know, half of this year is gone by, and the stock market certainly has lost value. S&P down more than 21% at this point. And that means local tech companies are taking a major hit. We're going to be joined by the founding partner of Volition Capital at 3:30 to talk more about what's in store for these tech capitals, companies, and what these VC companies that invest in tech are doing now. And I think it's fair to say that we all love Uno Pizzeria and Grill.
Yeah, no, I think that is fair.
It's a fun place to go. It's a local company based down in Norwood. Mm-hmm. And that company announcing that they are going to be expanding into hotels. Mm. The CEO, Eric Frederick, is going to join us in our 4 o'clock hour, tell us why they've made this decision and what kind of hotels we might see them in the near future. But first, as Joe just mentioned a moment ago, Chris Sale making his fourth rehab start in front of a sold-out Polar Park crowd for the AAA Worcester, as well against Scranton Wilkes Bar tonight. And joining us to talk a little bit more about it is the president and CEO of the Worcester Regional Chamber of Commerce, Tim Murray. And Tim, great to have you like always. And it's got to be great to have that big leaguer over there in that park for the fourth time. Good for business, right?
Yeah, without a doubt. Probably a sellout already. And just last week, I think serendipitously, they gave out Chris Sale bobbleheads at the Polar Park for last year's appearance. So the timing is pretty good with his coming back to Polar Park.
Tim, what does this mean for, I know this is just one event tonight, but Polar Park in general and in the larger context, if you could talk about the business impact that the presence of the park and, of course, big names like Chris Sale are having on that, that area.
Well, last year, again, with the season delayed and until mid-June, a cap on how many people could come into the ballpark and all of the 100 plus minor league baseball teams, the Worcester Red Sox attendance at Polar Park was sixth in the league. I think right now it's jockeying back and forth for this point in the season at one or two, and I have no doubt by the end of the season it'll be the highest in terms of attendance. But, to answer your question, Joe, on an average homestand, you're bringing tens of thousands of people into the city who oftentimes before and after are going to other parts of Worcester or coming into the city for the first time or in a long time and coming away with a great experience that, that makes them maybe more likely to come back for something else, which is a big part of what we want to see happen.
And, Tim, I know that it is just a Class A, AAA stadium, and being used for more things than just baseball, that has to be a real plus as well.
Yeah, great outdoor venue, number of community events. There was a big wine tasting. There's been some road races, fundraisers for various community groups and nonprofits last year. Again, you know, high school graduations and a number of high school baseball games were played here in the spring most recently. So the hope is that will continue, you know, potentially some hockey during the off season, some concerts. But I think that this is really the first full season with the whole ballpark complete. It was a bit of a work in progress because of some of the delays caused by COVID with an 8-week shutdown. But this year, it's absolutely magnificent, 360-degree experience around the park, and so far, you know, playing some great baseball, too.
Tim Murray's our guest. He's president and CEO of the Worcester Regional Chamber of Commerce, of course, former lieutenant governor here in the Commonwealth. Talk a little bit about the ripple in the pool, so to speak, the ripple effect here of Polar Park outside the park itself. I know that there's folks, there's lab space, there's biotech. What's going on in the immediate neighborhood?
Well, right now in the city of Worcester, there's 3,800 units of housing that are in construction or have been permitted. Probably 1,200 of those units, both market rate and affordable, are within probably 100 yards of Polar Park. So those are under construction as we speak. A number of new businesses that have opened up. And look, last year was a learning experience in how to calibrate parking and adjustments so you could facilitate people coming down, you know, beyond just the ballpark. So I think by and large, it has gone well for, you know, for the area businesses. And as I've said to others, you know, when you think about July and August, you know, the presence of the Worcester Red Sox is bringing tens of thousands of people into the city, and we're working with local businesses, the Canal District Alliance. Then how do we get them to take that those next steps before and after and on off-season and off-game days to come back? And so that's something that, you know, we see as an opportunity to leverage this even more fully.
And Tim, let's just talk about Worcester as a whole. You know, recession is being talked about. These have been some pretty tough times. Worcester has certainly been a community in Massachusetts that has been on the rise. What kind of effects are you seeing in that expansion and that continued growth there in Worcester because of recession issues?
Well, you know, manufacturing carried Worcester for 100 years, and that began to change in the 60s and 70s and really was the dominant, you know, sector of the economy. Since then, our economy and the sectors that drive it has become much more diverse. So that makes you a little bit more resilient when things hit a downturn. But, you know, the life sciences and biotech growing rapidly, certainly healthcare, higher ed, you know, those are all very strong and important sectors, as well as financial services. And a great startup community, an entrepreneurial community as well, being a city of immigrants and a gateway city. So that's a strength, that we have a diverse economy that's not wholly reliant on any one sector.
Tim Murray.
You're going to the game, Tim?
Yeah, you got
Tim?
I am going to the game, I'm excited about that. I missed it last year when Mr. Steele appeared, but also a big night at Fenway.
Yeah.
One of the top prospects, Brayon Bello, is going to be pitching. 23-year-old right-hander pitching at Fenway. So good cross-pollinization between Fenway and Polar Park.
Hey, Tim, when you get finished tonight, push Sail back this direction, can you? Tell him to sail back. Well, huh?
I think he will be. Maybe one more start here, then he'll be back to the
house. Tim and Joe, we have got to talk about the Swampscott Coyote. I mean, this is wild. And I think it's actually plural,
believe it or not. It's
the coyotes.
Yeah.
There's apparently a den of them. Mm-hmm. And they have bitten two people from June through now. And the Globe has a story now basically saying somebody's not going to be okay, is the quote that they have, because both people who were bitten were adults, but they did break the skin and they did come unprovoked. Mm-hmm. A woman was putting some leftovers from Bertucci's into her car, and she felt something brush against her leg. She thought it was a dog, and she turned and it was a coyote that was biting her leg, and then she had to get in the car and drive off bleeding. I mean, it's just wild.
Well, I got to tell you, the craziest part of all of this is that this is a really populated area with a lot of cars.
Yeah, it's
and
a
lot of
shopping plaza you're familiar with.
Yes. And it's hard to believe that they're so unafraid of humans that they're
right.
hanging out in this location. So, you know, I'm on the Swampscott Facebook, you know, whatever page, and people are outraged and just really upset about this for obvious reasons, right?
Yeah, no, they're, I mean, to your point, they're brazen at this point, and obviously they're hungry. So they don't even really care at this point. But
it's not a surprise to people that there's coyotes. I was saying to the two of you, there's a wetlands in Swampscott just along the water. And I think everyone knows that there are a number of them. There's a den of them that lives there. But the fact that they've gone as far as they have, which this is not close to that, and that there's so many people around. And they're also saying it's not necessarily at dusk and dawn. This is in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
I mean, this woman actually, she was bit at 10 o'clock at night. But they're seeing him everywhere. So.
Right, and then this guy, this other one was a man at an ATM machine at 6:40 in the morning.
Yeah.
So,
it's
concerning. I mean, the big issue I have is the possibility that people are feeding these animals. Mm. You know, it's not a good idea.
No, it's certainly
it just
not.
Seems so obvious to
right.
me. But
stay
people
tuned.
People love to feed wildlife, and I don't get it.
All right, and thank you. Let's move from that terrible story to another story that's a bit concerning. It's called the Misery Index, and it gauges household well-being based on the sum of inflation and unemployment. It shows conditions have deteriorated sharply right now and are now comparable to those seen in past downturns. So exactly what does all of that mean? Bloomberg economist Andrew Husby is with us to talk a little bit more about it. So, Andrew, let's just start with an understanding of what is the misery index and how it's gauged and how often is misery, read, if you will.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on. So this index, it's got its provenance back in the really big late 70s and 80s when you had Ronald Reagan essentially ask, do you feel better than you were 4 years ago? And if you add up one way to say that, one way to look at that is to say, okay, where are prices and where is inflation? And you add those two together and you get an index that economists have termed the misery index. It's usually trotted out around elections because of its history. And certainly that's something that's being trotted out right now. And I think the key to pull from it right now is that, even though unemployment is quite low, inflation, of course, at effectively 40-year highs. So, the readings we're seeing right now are at least as bad as we saw during the worst of the pandemic. They're just about as bad as we saw during the depths of the Great Recession. And they really rival those we saw in the 80s. So, certainly as we look ahead to the midterm elections, it's another factor that may be a headwind to Democrats this election season. Mm.
Andrew Husby is our guest. He is a Bloomberg economist. Okay, what has history taught us about the misery index? And I mean, when did the misery start?
Yeah, in this case, it really started for this episode. It started in mid 2021 when you have the combination of the climate of the pandemic, you have supply shocks, and then. Subsequent to that, more stimulus last year, and then you had further shock of Russia's war in Ukraine. So all of those have really combined to again push up inflation to a record high. And I think what is a good part of this is that, of course, the labor market is tight, wages are rising. But even if you subtract inflation from, say, wage growth, you get a measure called real or inflation-adjusted wages, and those have been running negative since effectively spring of last year. So. It feels like reasonably good times when you look at sort of top line macro aggregates, but at the household level, it's certainly a pretty broad pain out there at the moment.
And Andrew, when we first started this conversation, I said that it now compares to those seen in past downturns.
Mm-hmm.
Which downturns? Where do we compare? Maybe we can get a sense of where we are.
Yeah, it effectively worse than the Great Recession back in 2008-09. This is when we had effectively 10% unemployment or near 10% unemployment for a good stretch there. Inflation was a lot lower. And I think one thing to point out is this is also as bad as we saw in the 80s when inflation was far higher, but so was unemployment. So there's a silver lining here. But when it comes to how broadly inflation's felt. All households feel the inflation generally, while really unemployment actually just tends to be, not to diminish its importance, but it tends to be felt by a smaller fraction. And right now, that's the real benefit of this gauge, is it kind of gives you a sense of sort of economy-wide pain. And it really fits with the consumer sentiment numbers we're seeing, which were the worst last month since really on record. And those records date back to the 70s. And really, consumer sentiment, again, measured on that basis, is just as bad as it was during the 15 to 20% inflation years of back then.
Andrew Husby is a Bloomberg economist. We're talking about the misery index. And I'm just sort of struck when you said that the index currently is worse than in 2008 and 2009, when conditions were very tough. Is it primarily because inflation's so high?
It is very much that. Of course, the unemployment rate is at near a record low. We're at 3.6%. Our team expects it to actually start to tick up in the next few months. So that'll be a bit of a headwind, too, for some households and for the broader economy. But it is predominantly inflation. Inflation's running hot. Our team expects it to pick up a bit in the June data. We'll get that next week. So really, whatever we're seeing now, it will worsen.
You expect inflation to pick up?
We do. June will look pretty strong. Our team's penciling in about a 1% gain month over month, and that's going to mean we're going to close in on something like 9% year over year. So that would be a fresh high. Sure.
So the rate increases aren't working?
They will work, but they work at a lag, and a lot of what's driving inflation right now, food, energy, and the like, are not really amenable to monetary policy solutions. So right now, it's going to be a hot summer for prices, but we do expect that to start to tail off towards the end of the year. But you know, that does depend on that bold and brave assumption that we don't get further shocks, further flare-ups in geopolitics and the like.
So, Andrew, let me ask you. You said in the beginning that frequently we take a look at the misery index as we get closer to elections. In the past, when the misery index has looked pretty miserable, has the party in power paid the price?
It has. We've looked at in the past more. It's more tailored to presidential election cycles, and what you really care about there is sort of how it's evolving in the. Year ahead of the election, and at the moment, it is evolving, and we expect it to be evolving in an unfavorable direction for the incumbent party. So that does. You know, there is a view out there that even in a normal year, the incumbent party tends to lose seats after a presidential election during those midterms, and this is another factor that would lean in that direction too.
How about this headline? A new VC firm focused on underrepresented founders just announced its first fund. Now, general partner and co-founder Yasmin Cruz Farine sat down with our Janet Wu. She explains the mission of Visible Hands.
We highlight and invest in the potential of overlooked founders exclusively at the earliest stage. So we're a venture capital firm with an accelerator program.
You just announced the launch of your first fund. How much did you raise?
We raised $10.5 million for Fund 1.
That's fairly small compared to most venture funds. How will you be investing?
So we have a two-check model, actually. We write a first check of $25,000, and then we spend 14 weeks with the founders. And in that period, we really get to know them, figure out exactly what they need to accomplish, and then if the market opportunity is venture backable, if the team is strong, and they're on their way to building a strong product, then we write an additional $150,000.
You're talking about underrepresented founders. What kind of ideas and companies are you looking for?
We are sector agnostic. We're looking for tech and tech-enabled companies.
This is a busy time for you. Just 2 months ago, you announced a partnership with Google. How did you get one of the world's largest techs to work with your brand new venture firm?
For us, we saw great alignment in needing to support the Latinx community. So we decided to join forces and to work on this, given our mutual aligned interests.
We are speaking with Yasmin Cruz Farin, co-founder and general partner of VC firm Visible Hands. Tell us how this program to amplify Latino entrepreneurs will work.
For VHLX, it will be a 20-week program. It's virtual first. We will work with them on a specific issue, whether that is working on their MVP, working on customer research, which is really important to get out of the gate strong, or working on becoming investment ready and ready to pitch next their seed stage potential investors. And we'll spend that time together. We'll actually have opportunities to have investors come and mentor and other operators mentor our founders. And at the end, we'll have a showcase.
We should point out that 12% of the residents in Massachusetts identify as Latino, but companies with Latino founders account for less than 4% of capital invested. That's according to Crunchbase. Now, certainly, your startup accelerator has demand. Tell us how many applications you had for that first class.
We have a flagship accelerator, which is separate from VHLX with Google. For our flagship accelerator, the first year, we had 911 applicants, and we selected 50 fellow founders to work with. And in our second year, this past spring, we had 1,418 applicants. So we have, over the past year, past 2 years, built out quite a robust pipeline of overlooked founders.
You run your accelerator similar to the model at MIT. You demand high benchmarks and you put them through a lot of training. Can you give us some examples of how you work with these founders?
Certainly. We don't believe that founders need coursework or additional curriculum. What we do is we identify exactly a tangible business outcome. And that could be design support, hiring support. It could be becoming investment ready. And depending on what that founder's need is, we work with them. And it's virtual first. And in addition to our staff, you know, coming in, rolling up our sleeves, doing market research with them, developing these prototypes, we also bring a community of advisors to also support and meet with the founders, add value there. And then, Janet, really a huge value proposition is the peer-to-peer support. Many of these overlooked founders have not been in environments where they feel seen, supported, and surrounded. And that peer-to-peer support, being in the cohort of other underrepresented founders, really also helps propel these founders.
We are speaking with Yasmin Cruz Farin, co-founder and general partner of VC firm Visible Hands. Yasmin, what led you and your partners to found this firm? Was there a moment of inspiration, or was this idea simmering for a long time?
So I have two other co-founders and general partners. Each of us had a different angle and entry point. My co-founder, Daniel Anchampong, he came from growth equity, and he was a part of firms that was raising sizable capital, and he could see that there was a lot of dry powder and certainly not enough investment in underrepresented founders. And then my other co-founder, Justin King, he started his career at Global Accelerators. He's obsessed with company building, but didn't see enough of his peers stick it out. And by the time, you know, go on to raise, you know, attractive rounds of capital, many of them, too much talent was dying on the vine. And then for me, I came from various finance background on public equities, different size institutions from public to more boutique firms. And I saw similarly that there was underinvestment in both on emerging managers and the founders. What we wanted to do together is invest in founders that before was obvious to the market, that there'd be a really compelling investment opportunity.
Tell us about your investors. How many LPs and who are they?
So we have 67 LPs total. We have 6 institutional LPs. The institutional LPs include Bank of America, Brown Advisory, THL on the institutional side, and then we have 61 high net worth individuals and families that are investors.
Are you mostly investing in Massachusetts or elsewhere?
Interesting. So in our first year, we were investing in New York, LA, and the Bay Area, then Boston. And then this year, the founders that were writing checks to Atlanta has snuck in there, but some of the other same ecosystem.
Finally, why the name Visible Hands?
We believe that if market forces corrected on their own, you wouldn't see some of these acute imbalances in access to capital, and we want to be there to provide that hand in making sure that market forces are checked and are rebalanced.
Lots of shark news today.
Oh.
First of all, there is a wild video filmed, just posted to Boston.com, filmed at Nauset Outer Beach in Orleans, mm-hmm. where a family is standing on the shore and you can see the waves breaking and a huge shark attacking and eating a seal, like right in front of them. It's wild.
Yeah, you can see the headline on Boston.com, literally in front of us. Yeah,
emailed it to all of my family saying, reminder, these sharks can come really close. I saw so many seals on the Cape this weekend in our little boat. It was really fun, but I'm constantly worried about sharks.
Where there's a seal, there's a shark, usually.
There's a shark. And then Boston Herald has a story just up that a great white shark washed up on a Cape Cod beach.
Really?
And researchers are trying to determine the cause of death. No obvious signs of trauma, they say.
Hmm.
This is on Sandy Neck Beach in Barnstable.
Oh, wow. Yeah, sure.
So, Joe, you know that area really well. The shark washed up on the 4th of July, and it's a juvenile male shark, and there are a lot of photos of that up on the web, too. So, again, this is the kind of thing my sons and my husband live for.
the sharks,
shark updates any kind of
Wild Kingdom.
Yeah. And there's the Sharktivity app, of course, that everyone's using, the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy's app. It's a lot of fun. We can't stop. But it's hard to swim, relax.
My brother has that Sharktivity app, and he feels obligated every time there's a shark sighting, to tell everyone. It's
Joe,
all right, we
I
get it.
I feel your pain.
We get it.
I feel your pain. I don't think I've gotten through an entire meal without someone in my family announcing that there's a shark near us.
Yes, there are.
All right. Thanks very much. Market decline has resulted in some really difficult times for some local tech companies. Let me give you a couple examples. Cambridge software company HubSpot has dropped nearly 54% in the first half of this year. DraftKings is down 58%. Wayfair down 77%. Our next guest is a founding partner of Volition Capital in Boston. Larry Chang, thanks so very much for being with us. First thing I want to do before we get into all of this tech news is just tell us a little bit about Volition Capital.
Yeah, Volition is an internet and software growth equity firm built in Boston, founded in 2010. So we invest in private companies that are generally in that 5 to 20 million revenue range, looking for their first large institutional partners. That's where we live.
Mm. So, Larry, tell us what's going on in that space right now. What's the changes you've seen? Where are we?
Probably the public markets are where the attention is, because those trickle down into the private markets where we invest. There's usually a bit of a lag, but you've seen that, as you discussed, many public companies have fallen by 50, even to 80 or 90% from their peak to now. And that's starting to make its way through into the private markets, where capital used to be free-flowing and valuations used to be very high. The transaction volume has slowed down quite a bit. Valuations are starting to ratchet back, and as the public markets have ratcheted back, but everyone's trying to figure out, where do things settle? In the private markets, you don't have to raise capital, and so some companies are just waiting and delaying taking on more capital at this time.
Larry Chang is our guest. He's a founding partner of Volition Capital here in Boston. Larry, in a recent interview, you talked about the fact that this downturn is similar to what happened to the dot-com crash back in, between 2000 and 2002. You also compared it to the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009. But you say there's some differences, too. So talk to us a little bit about what you see as being different.
The confluence of really negative indicators is probably what's different. In the last two downturns that you discussed, the peak to trough comps in the public markets fell about 90% for emerging technology companies. So you, if you looked at that alone, there's still more to go from a downturn perspective. But what's happening right now is not only have the equity markets fallen, but the bond markets have gotten off to the worst start in some cases in history. And you have relatively low interest rates with very high inflation. The confluence of those four all together at once isn't what happened in the prior two downturns. So I think we are in uncharted territories. In the prior downturns, the Fed just lowered rates and quantitative easing happening, and that sort of helped to bring markets back. But the Fed can't do that right now, and so we'll see how we navigate our way out of it.
Well, Larry, what does this mean for young companies that are unprofitable, say, at this point, and in need of capital? I mean, what do you see there?
great question. I guess the name of the game is don't need capital. So young companies that have been living off of the presumption that financing awaits them in the future that's very favorable, so they can burn a lot of cash today, that is a high-risk assumption to make in this market. So what companies are doing across the country is they are driving down cost structure, they're improving their operating leverage, and they're basically trying to survive on the cash that they have, if not thrive on the cash that they have, and drive towards profitability. For a long while, profit hasn't been in the vernacular of the startup world, but it has come back.
And Larry, I know that you have said that you think that some of these companies that are not startups but are some really powerful companies are going to still see a lot of hurt and may not make it. Give us some examples of who you're talking about.
I don't know if they won't make it, but I don't think the challenge in the market's over. So what you saw in the first half of the year was largely multiple compression. A lot of the companies like the HubSpot that you mentioned, it's not as though their performance suddenly fell by 50%. They're still growing. They're still doing relatively well, but their value fell by 50%. Mm-hmm. I think what you're going to see in the second half of the year is actual earnings and performance that becomes challenged in those companies. So I think that could lead to another reset in valuations down because everyone's tightening their belts. They're spending less. Those types of indicators will lead to poor performance in the months and quarters to come. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, so are you still funding startups? Is Volution still funding startups? And if so, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely we are. I mean, thankfully, we fund companies today with an outlook for 5 to 10 years from now, so you don't get overly caught up in what's happening right now for a new investment. We just invested in a company called Sensible Care, which provides teletherapy online and telepsychiatry online. And it's a growth segment that is in high demand nationwide. So this company is based and launched in California, but we hope to bring it to Massachusetts soon enough. And so we're looking at core consumer services, essential enterprise software, those types of areas that continue to perform well, even in more challenging economic times.
And have you found more of those out there, by the way? I know you just mentioned that one. Are there more out there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah. Security software is a very strong area. Supply chain software is a very strong area. Yeah. There are core consumer services, everything from pharmacy to cellular services and household essentials all perform well. Even the used car market performs well in markets like these, but the new car market really takes a downturn. So we're looking with a longer-term view, and so absolutely we are funding companies. And the good thing is there's always innovation irrespective of the market cycles that's happening.
After a busy 4th of July holiday weekend, and really what was considered a major holiday week, we're finally seeing a return of guests to our hotels and to our restaurants. Our tourist attractions seem to be packed. We're joined by Martha Sheridan, President and CEO of the Greater Boston Convention and Visitors Bureau. And it seemed like it was a pretty terrific weekend for the city of Boston, Martha. Are we on target here?
Good afternoon. It's nice to be with you both today. We are actually, it was a great weekend. We had, as you know, the return of the iconic Esplanade concert and fireworks. We had Harborfest happening, activities in Chinatown, so things happening throughout the city. But I have to say, this weekend was not really the start of our long-awaited recovery. It was really the early part of June and even late in May when we really started to see a lot of activity in the city, and our hotel occupancy soars. So we are definitely heading in the right direction.
Martha Sheridan's our guest. She's the president and CEO of the Greater Boston Convention and Visitors Bureau. Let's talk about that, Martha. Take us through late May into June and where we are now in July in terms of, you know, let's talk about the hotel industry, I guess. Occupancy rates, what are you seeing, and are they holding up?
They are definitely rebounding. We're hoping in some cases, such as in June, we will surpass even 2019 occupancy numbers, pushing up in the high 80s, maybe 90%. We know that May was very, very strong as well, with graduations returning. Of course, the Celtics playoffs didn't hurt us for May and June, and we have a lot of citywide conventions. So the city is definitely coming back, and we're very excited to see so much activity.
Martha, let's talk about the convention business. What's it look like now as compared to 2019 at this time?
We definitely still have more citywide conventions happening throughout the summer and more to come in the fall. So the number of conventions is pretty solid. The attendance levels are still not back to pre-pandemic levels, and that's not just a Boston phenomenon. Depending on the group, some are getting closer to their pre-pandemic numbers, but I would say on average we're hovering somewhere around 75% mm-hmm. in that regard. So a little bit of work to do to get that business traveler back on the road, that convention traveler. But we're feeling very optimistic about that as well.
Well, let's talk about that if we could, Martha, then, because obviously right there in your title, Boston Convention and Visitors Bureau, share with us, if you could, the latest data or stats as it relates to, visitors and the international figure as well.
Well, international is still, we're waiting for that recovery, although if you look at numbers from Logan Airport, you can see significant increases in the last couple of years with international inbound getting not quite to 19 levels, but, you know, moving in the right direction there. We hope that with the lifting of that pre-testing requirement that we had for inbound international, that number is going to continue to soar. I think that also the convention numbers, as I said, are solid, but the one market segment that we're still sort of hoping and praying for and waiting to come back, and again across the board nationally, is that individual corporate traveler that's mm-hmm. coming to Boston on their own for a few nights to conduct business. We haven't seen that rebound to the levels that we would like to, or not even near pre-pandemic levels yet.
Well, and Martha, I understand how important the business traveler is, and I know we've all got our fingers crossed that maybe even the fall will help to a certain extent there. But let's talk about the tourists that are here. Are they spending money? Are they getting into restaurants? Do you know? Are they seeing, you know, old Ironsides? Are they doing all the things that tourists do?
Oh, absolutely. The attractions and restaurants are doing quite well. I would say the one caveat for some of them is the labor shortage that mm-hmm. we currently have. So I'm a Boston resident. I do know that many of my favorite spots aren't open on Mondays right now, which was not the case pre-pandemic. But, you know, the nights that they are open, they're doing quite well. And anecdotally, our attractions seem to be doing quite well. But again, you know, it's a matter of capacity. If you don't have enough, you know, trolley drivers, or if you don't have enough crew on your tour boats, you're not running as many boats or trolleys as you would like to. So I think that's still something that's impacting the travel sector, but there's certainly a desire on the part of the visitor to take advantage of all the activities happening.
Martha Sheridan's our guest with the Greater Boston Convention and Visitors Bureau. Okay, so you mentioned it. We had the NBA playoffs. You know, that helped. We had the U.S. Open golf. We can't forget that. We had the 4th of July, and all of these, you know, contributing to the hospitality industry, the restaurants, the hotels, all the tourist attractions. But what's next on your calendar, Martha? Mm-hmm. What's the next trick up your sleeve in terms of, you know, this good news, keeping it going?
Well, for the summer months, we have a very, very packed schedule of events that are taking place. You've obviously got Red Sox baseball. We'll mention that the Yankees series will start soon. That's always a very popular one with visitors to the city. So
Boo.
Hoping that will fill hotel rooms.
Yeah.
But also, you know, the Fenway concert series are underway. TD Garden has a great list of concerts. So obviously now we're restriction free, so we are seeing more activity in our venues and arenas, so that's helpful. Of course, we've got a lot of our outdoor festivals in August. We have Green Fest. That draws about 30 to 35,000 people a day. We've got our beloved festivals in the North End in August. So there is no shortage of things to do. And I think, too, visitors to the city in this day and age are really looking for outdoor activity. And we've got plenty of that with the Greenway and all of our amazing parks, Jamaica Pond, and, again, all the activities that take place in our neighborhoods. You know, Roxbury has a lot going on for activities, Jamaica Plain, et cetera. So those are things that are really going to keep us busy throughout the summer, and we're pretty confident. Leisure visitation is strong, no question about it. Is it strong enough to fill every gap that we have from corporate and international? Maybe not.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, it's pretty solid, and people are anxious to come to Boston and stay in our hotels.
So Martha, you've sort of answered my next question. You know, we're all flying high with this great news, and we've got the leisure traveler back. But the fact of the matter is, Labor Day does come, kids go back to school, the leisure traveler goes home, and possibly we all move indoors and COVID issues begin again. So what are you guys anticipating, and what kind of moves are being made to prepare for the fall?
The fall is not an everybody goes home season for the city of Boston. Thankfully, we like to ride the coattails of our friends to the north and their mm-hmm. beautiful fall foliage. So that draws people from near and far. And people, when they do come in to the New England area to experience our incredible scenic foliage, they do like to make a stop in the city of Boston. And don't forget, our college students come back mm-hmm. In late August, and that fills our rooms because you've got move-in days, which are staggered now. You've got parents' weekends. You've got, you know, college sports. And again, the, you know, Red Sox will continue to play. So we're pretty confident that, that things are going to be very, very robust right through the fall. And I will say, I'm actually trying to book a flight to London right now in July, and airfares for international are through the roof. I'm sure it's not just Americans going that way. I'm sure it's for, you know, Europeans and residents of the UK coming this way. So hopefully, you know, the fall sees some, you know, loosening of those sure. airfares, and we'll get more people back.
Sure.
Well, we've been talking a lot about the good news, Martha, but certainly it's not all rainbows and unicorns. Where are your concerns?
Well, obviously the economy, you know, weighs on us a bit. We've got, you know, issues with gas prices, although in this region, that's less impactful just because we have such a dense drive market population, so people don't have to drive that far to get to us. But inflation is a concern. You know, labor shortages are still a concern, especially as we move later into the summer when our college student workforce goes back to school and our, you know, older high schoolers go back to school. That concerns me as well. You know, and hopefully this, you know, the gas prices don't impact airfares too dramatically, but of course, we do have concerns around air travel and labor shortages there as well. So all of that, you know, can have an impact on us long term, but we're keeping our fingers crossed that, you know, it's not too severe.
Well, Martha, I got to tell you, I think you've put a smile on everybody in the studio's faces here. You know, we were all out and about over the weekend and certainly on Monday, and we talked about the throngs of people who were in the streets as they were headed toward the Esplanade and how, you know, coming from Fenway Park and how great that looked. It's good to know that a lot of them were staying, a lot of them were visitors, and that they're filling those hotels. My one last question for you very quickly here. How are the hotels doing with their staffing?
You know, there are some issues. There are gaps for sure. Mm-hmm. But I think they're doing okay, all things considered. I mean, they are still, you know, able to fill to capacity. So that's a really good thing. And we're hoping that visitors are patient when it comes to dining out and, you know, the challenges that we have in our restaurants and our food outlets. But all in all, people, I think, understand what, you know, what the situation sure. is. And they've been good. And I'm always happy that you all have smiles on your faces. Lord knows it wasn't always this way.
That's
for me, right.
That's right. We've all been talking when it wasn't so great.
As promised, we're going to be chatting this half hour with the CEO of a well-known local company. We're talking about the CEO of Norwood-based Uno Pizzeria and Grill, and the CEO is Eric Frederick, and he's on the line with us now. Now, Uno Pizzeria and Grill, they've got 16 locations in Massachusetts, 73 nationally, and there's a new effort to locate these restaurants, which are franchises, inside established hotels. We learned about this in an article in the Boston Business Journal, a story written by BBJ reporter Grant Welker. Pizzeria Uno has new expansion plans, specifically hotels. Eric, thank you very much for joining us. We do appreciate it. Perhaps we could start, because Uno Pizzeria and Grill is a private company. So why don't you give us a snapshot of the company and its people and employees?
Yeah, sure. Hey, thanks, and appreciate you having me on. So, so as you say, we've got 33 restaurants in the United States. We've got about another seven throughout the rest of the world. We've got some in India and some in the Middle East as well. But, yes, we've been privately held. I myself have been here since 2018, originally as the chief financial officer, helping, you know, lead the transformation to the next era for Uno, and then tapped for CEO in April of 2020, so somewhat of a battlefield promotion there in the restaurant industry. But we've been a mainstay here in New England really since the early 80s, when a man named Aaron Spencer, who was a pretty significant Kentucky Fried Chicken franchisee, bought the franchise rights for Pizzeria Uno. Of course, you know, we're founded in Chicago and really the birthplace of deep dish pizza. You know, the company has since moved on or moved beyond deep dish, I should say, into thin crust. And actually, we're doing some work with Detroit-style pizza right now as well. So at the end of the day, we just want to be making amazing pizza as well as, you know, other great food items along the way.
Well, Eric, really interesting, you guys now thinking that the expansion road for you is through these hotels. Before we get into how you plan to do that, interesting time for you to expand, period, when it comes to this line of work, restaurants and going into hotels, all areas that have been hit pretty hard. Why now?
Sure. So it's always time to grow. And I'd say even that when things are really tough, it's an even better time to grow. So that's the big thing on why now. And look, at the end of the day, you know, we, you know, as a if times are tough, you've got to keep growing, you know, to feed your, you know, your to offset some of the other difficulties you're going to have with inflation and commodity increases and all that. And it's also people want to come to work at a place that's going to grow and they've got a future and say, okay, well, we're going to have more restaurants and then, you know, going forward than we have today and all of that. So, you know, I think no time like the present.
All right. Eric Frederick is our guest, the CEO of Uno Pizzeria and Grill. He's been in that position since 2020. Okay. So tell us about your expansion plans. What's up?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, when we tried to figure out how we were going to grow, you know, a lot of different avenues, company restaurants, very expensive to add, to build new restaurants, especially from scratch. And that really does go to the why now. Is this a great time to do that and everything? So that seemed like that might be daunting. And you know, even with the ones that we have, if you think about 16 in, you know, New England, to make that even a material amount, you'd have to do several, and that could take a long time. Then we started, of course, you know, we've got a lot of franchisees here with the traditional bar and grill format, about 6,000 square feet, and we're definitely open to doing that if you know, a franchisee wants to do that. Make no mistake, we're not by any means turning our back on that. What attracted us to the hotel restaurant conversion was, you know, as with any you know, business relationship, it really comes down to, are you bringing value to somebody you know, in a way that few other people can do it. And we think we've got something here, at least our initial customers agree, is if you think about it, a lot of hotels, the food and beverage program, especially, you know, when they're full service, is a necessary evil. Their overarching brand mandates it, right? If you're going to have this kind of a hotel brand, and of course, you know, they're all primarily franchised, right? I think Marriott might own probably fewer than five actual hotels. The rest are franchised. And, you know, you go into a, you know, whether it's a Delta or a DoubleTree, they're mandated, you know, to have a full service restaurant. And a lot of it's a necessary evil, and a surprisingly large amount break even or don't even make money on their restaurants. So we think we can bring a lot of value to them. If you thought about, especially where they're already either changing brands and upgrading, you know, from you know, one brand to another, or just going through a normal refresh of the restaurant. And the reason I say that is if you think about your typical hotel restaurant, you know, our premise is that we're absolutely going to help them have a higher capture rate of guests who eat in. But whenever you think about a hotel restaurant, you always see all this takeout pizza come in the front door. So mm-hmm. now all of a sudden they're going to grab that revenue stream. Mm-hmm. And by the way, if they're going to eat it in the restaurant, they're probably going to order a drink or two that they may not have if they just got takeout from a local place. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you're staying in a hotel, by definition, you probably don't have much knowledge of what great, you know, pizzas are around there other than what the desk may tell you and all of that. Even then, they still may not have a good pizza place. Mm-hmm. So then... by going on DoorDash or Grubhub, they're going to get local delivery. And I don't know about you, but I can't remember ever getting takeout or delivery from a local hotel's restaurant. And then what we're seeing in our first ones that are out there is they're actually getting people from the local community to come in and eat at their restaurant. So it's a great revenue stream for them.
We're talking with Eric Frederick. He is the CEO of Uno Pizzeria and Grill. So I want to understand this, Eric. So, let's walk backward for just a second.
Yeah.
So as we go to these hotels, will the franchisee be the hotel, or will there be a franchisee who takes it into a hotel?
Great question. So the hotel operator is really the target because they're the franchisee of the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So they would be the ones who would then also be a franchisee of Uno for their food and beverage program.
Okay.
Let's talk about being a franchisee, because beyond the hotels, which would be buying in at this point, you have individual franchisees in these, well, certainly these other locations, and the 16 you mentioned in New England. What does it take to become a franchisee? What's the capital needed up front, and how does that business arrangement work?
So good question. And again, it speaks to why we find it attractive in our conversations with hotel operators. Our first conversion was outside of O'Hare, and they spent upwards of a little over $500,000. In their complete remodel and conversion. And that contrasts with, if you want to build a standalone hotel from scratch, it's going to cost you $2 to $3 million to do that. Now, here's the catch. Because they're moving from one brand to a Marriott Delta, they were going to spend a good chunk, if not a majority of that money already, because they had to reface the public area. You know, there is some equipment that we have that they probably wouldn't. You know, there's a specific, they're going to need an oven, but we're going to make them have a specific one. And, you know, they're going to have mixer and other pizza equipment. But so all of a sudden it becomes really only a couple $100,000 for them to convert, as opposed to someone who wants to start from scratch. And then the good news is if you build a restaurant from scratch, we all have our favorite pizza place. So you're fighting it out to get every customer, whereas they get brand new customers every week. Mm-hmm. And so... So that's sort of the deal. We've got, you know, a franchise fee, as well as, you know, we charge a royalty and a marketing co-op contribution. And that's really what it goes into, you know, kind of goes into it.
And how much jurisdiction do you have over these locations once these franchisees buy in, the royalties are being paid, and the upfront money is paid?
Well, I guess when you say jurisdiction, it's
is there any control, Eric? Do you guys have any control over those franchise locations?
We do. They absolutely have to represent the brand well. They've got to, you know, adhere to sort of our standards of quality and both food and guest experience. We have zero control over how they operate with their employees. And that's true within the franchising industry. That's up to the franchisee to do. They set their own pricing, of which we provide guidance for. There's a lot of things that we provide guidance for, but in terms of control, it's really about your restaurant's got to hit these brand standards of the way things look and operate. With the hotels, there's a little bit of give and take with the mother brand, if you will, the hotel brand. So it's got to look like it fits in, and mm-hmm. which we want anyways. We don't want something to look out of place. But a lot of it is really keeping them, you know, really up to quality levels, which, of course, is good business for them.
Talking with the CEO of Norwood-based Uno Pizzeria and Grill, Eric Frederick, about their expansion plans into hotels, a story we saw in the BBJ. All right, I'm curious about a couple of things here. The hotels, all right, that are going to be, well, the franchisee here, how do we select the hotels? I mean, who's on your list? Or do they choose you or do you choose them? And then how long is this rollout plan?
Yeah, sure. So far, many have come to us. So we've got several more in the pipeline, and they've, you know, heard about what we're doing and think it's a great opportunity. We've been to a few shows and talked to them. But I would say there's a couple things that really go into it. And a lot of it is one of our core values is really passion for what we do. Passion will take you beyond, here's an ops manual, go do it, right? It's what's going to say, I'm going to make sure we have great guest experience. I'm going to make sure that we have our pizza comes out awesome. And it's going to just go beyond, here comes Uno's to inspect this next week or something. That's something we look for. And frankly, we look for people who are going to fit into our culture. We've got one of the best, really strong culture within our franchise organization. Very, very, you know, few, if any, issues with our franchisees. And we want someone who's going to fit into that. And not only does it make it easier to operate, frankly, it's really good business because difficult relationships with franchisees really serve no one's economic interest. And as I say, don't really work. So we're looking for someone who really cares about the brand, and it's not just a pure transaction. And, you know, luckily we've got a pipeline that affords us the ability to do that. So in terms of how long we see ourselves doing this, I mean, this is our strategy for, as far as the eye can see. Do I have a specific number in mind with my board of how many we want to get to? Yeah, but we've also, we've only been at this. We've got three in that are actually up, and open. We'll have a total of 10 open and under agreement by October. So, I don't want to get carried away with throwing out massive numbers that we may or may not get to. The other thing, too, that is, with our growth is we want to make sure we do it right. And you can grow too fast sometimes it's critical that we're able to support our franchisees in terms of training and being there for them, especially when they first start and all that, to make sure they make that great first impression with their guests and everything like that. Mm-hmm. One thing we won't do is we won't take jerks, and we won't go someplace where we can't successfully support somebody. So if someone's in, Montana, we probably don't have the logistics and the support to take them there. So we're only going to go places where we can really position them for success because we think that's the best long-term solution.
So, Eric, let's talk a little bit about the existing Unos. Will they be affected by this? Will some of them, be closed and moving into hotels? Is that the ultimate goal to no longer have? I know you said that if a franchisee would like to have a standalone operation, you would be in support. But is the corporate overall goal to sort of stay away from that?
No. By no means. We've got our restaurants that we have, and part of the thing we had to do getting through COVID is we got our portfolio of restaurants down to only those that were profitable and close enough to it to where we could see light at the end of the tunnel in 2019. And so our goal is to operate those restaurants. However, if I thought about, if there was a hotel operator in the Boston area, say, where I've got a really strong, team and some folks I'd love to give some upward mobility to that said, maybe I don't want to be a franchisee, but I'd love to do an operating agreement with you guys. We'd be open to that conversation and all that. And so it's by no means a strategy to exit what we're doing. We just think this is an area that we can grow in and create a win-win.
Eric Frederick is our guest, CEO of Uno Pizzeria and Grill. So tell us a little bit about where you've done this already out in the Midwest and whatever success you're having there. And then you said you've already got 10 planned already. Can you share some hotel names with us too?
Yeah, sure. So I'd rather talk about where they're going for those that are converting. So we've got one, as I mentioned, outside of O'Hare, who is in the Choice system now, but they're converting to a Delta. So that's one. And we have another Delta outside of Detroit. And then we have an independent in Indiana Dunes. And for those that don't know their Indiana geography, it is at the very southern tip of Lake Michigan. And it's actually the adjacent restaurant, which is called the Speakeasy. And I will tell you, they spent very little converting because it was an old Al Capone hideout, if you will, or back in the day. I'm from Chicago. I will tell you, a lot of people claim that, whether it's true or not. But they, in particular, have approached us about converting three other hotels that they're that they have recently bought and are in the process of buying. Mm-hmm. So one of them will be in South Carolina, another in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and the third in LaPorte, Indiana. We've got our franchisee in outside of Detroit. We're trying to work with him to put together a concept in Palm Beach, Florida. Hmm. And then we're hopefully going to be able to announce some things in the next by the end of the month in Texas. So until we sort of have those, I don't want to really announce. And then we've also have one of our existing franchisees who is not in a hotel, but he loves our concept, and he's going to build a smaller version, almost a fast casual version of what we have. Not part of the hotel strategy, but again, we just want to be known for making great pizza, and he's on board for building something new. And then the other thing, and it's a little bit not in the article about hotels, is we're also doing takeout only. We're piloting a takeout only concepts. We have a new franchisee in Chicago who approached us about doing that. And then we're building a prototype in Orlando, which we hope to open here by the end of July.
And Eric, you might have answered this already, but when you go into these hotels, you talked about your 6,000 square foot standalones. Obviously, that's pretty large for going into these hotels. So these will be more scaled down, sort of like what you were saying. Someone wants to build a more scaled down with a scaled down menu.
So a couple things. So the physical size will pretty much be the physical size they have. Right.
Mm-hmm,
and
right.
So we've got, a design firm that'll work with them to make it sort of look a lot like our downtown Chicago original Uno. The size part will depend on that. In terms of the menu size, it'll absolutely be, in most cases, I should say, be scaled down. So we've got a culinary team and a fairly broad menu. We've got about 85 items on our menu now. They would not do that. So just because the typical hotel guest isn't looking for all of that, it would definitely be pizza centric. But they'd have a pasta, a few pastas. They'd have some, certainly a fish and a steak and a chicken, as well as some of our signature appetizers. But definitely more scaled down than what we have. And that's what they're looking for to keep, because they've got the same labor challenges everybody else has. Mm-hmm. So.
Eric Frederick is our guest. So I'm reading your bio here, and it's, it says you got your MBA from the University of Virginia, and it also, and then it says you were a CPA in Massachusetts. So tell us about that.
I did go to grad school in Virginia. I was a naval officer before that, and so that is a way to transition to the private sector, if you will. So the CPA, I started to work at Staples and just wanted to, didn't really have strong accounting skills. I mean, it's not really something I focused on in grad school. And, I'll throw it out there. It was on a dare to take the test, so I did.
Okay.
But I've never actually used it, so.
I see. Now you're selling pizzas. Is that what you tell Mom?
Well, you know, I'm actually from Chicago, so right. I was eating deep dish in a high chair. So
there you go.
It's been a phenomenal ride, but yeah, it's good fun, and I'll tell you, sometimes you know things get really hectic and stressful, and you know you just have to smile at the team members and say, you know what, we're just selling pizza, and the best was I was having a stressful day, and one of the women on our marketing team said, just smiled at me and said, Eric, we're just selling pizza, and all of a sudden. I mean, it was like a verbal hug, and always.
Well, good luck with that, and good luck with just selling pizza. We cheer you on, Norwood-based Uno Pizzeria and Grill, Eric Frederick. Thanks for being our guest today on Bloomberg Bay State Business. And as Tom Maroney would say, there he goes.
Interesting concept, actually, in a great way, it seems to me, to be thinking, you know, forward thinking. What are new ways and new concepts?
And I'm sitting there thinking, okay, somebody listening to this who's in that line of work, oh, are we going to start copying you?
Right, yeah. Right. Progressive ideas, though, really good.
Yeah. All right. So it is time to talk about tomorrow on Bloomberg Bay State Business as the clock is running away with us. We're going to be talking a little bit about, well, we talked with Jeff Myers with Colliers International about this whole idea of using, some of our empty storefronts, right. Some of our empty buildings for housing, right?
Right. Kim? It's happening in a number of cities, but doesn't seem to be taking hold here. And we're going to be talking to Jeff Myers about why that's the case.
We're also going to be talking about electric cars. I'm sure that I know myself. I'm sitting there thinking about it as I was paying $5 a gallon for gas. And Bloomberg Green is out with a whole rating system, a very in-depth look as the whole electric car market and rating them from 1 to 10. And it's no surprise that Tesla is number one,
right.
But the rest of the list would be a little bit of a surprise to you. And also up on Beacon Hill tomorrow, they're going to be talking about new legislation as it relates to cannabis in the state of Massachusetts and the possibility of opening up marijuana or pot cafes in a community near you. We're back tomorrow at 2 p.m. Join us then. This is Bloomberg.